Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're broadcasting all over the world, and the point of the exercise is to empower people. And to do that, I'm looking at different topics that normally do not get the attention they deserve, and certainly not in an objective manner. Today, the latest on health and healing. It's right in front of us. From purple carrots that I'll discuss to the leaves of the carob tree. Also diet sodas, what's in them that you may not be aware of. And even new ways of treating colorectal cancer. All of this information comes from peer-reviewed mainstream science. I always cite these specific references. And the reason I do this is because how many times have you gone to your healthcare provider and suggested that, let's say, for your eyes, or your kidneys, or your skin, or your joints, or your heart, you said you heard something that was natural, non-toxic, that could help. And immediately the person just swatted it down, saying, nonsense. That's not based upon credible, proven science. And if you're not prepared, if you don't have the information, then who are you to argue with the doctor? So I want you to have everything you need so you can have a dialogue with your doctor. Take them the studies. It's the doctor who is out of the loop on what is real good science. Also today, no guests, because I want to spend some time sharing some commentaries. I spent the better part of 5 or 6 hours writing on a list of topics. Plus, I'll be sharing from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, A Time for Sublime Madness, from Colin Todd Hunter, from Countercurrents, The Lies of Democracy and the Language of Deceit. This was made given to my attention by Luann Panessi, so I read it and I was impressed with it. From our environmental segment, in-depth discussion from Green Med Info, Scott Tips, The Trans-Pacific Slam Job. As you know, I am opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This is NAFTA and GATT on steroids. It will virtually be the last and final battle that any union will wage with any substance or meaning. If we do not become aware of how dangerous this legislation, this will dwarf Citizens United in its consequences. And yet there's very little being done to challenge it. I'm trying to rush in, with all my schedule being packed as it is, a documentary on all of our treaties, showing you that none of our treaties have ever been on our behalf. They've always been to the betterment of the corporate people and their lobbyists and the legislators who pass them, always against us. So I'm hopeful to have a documentary completed prior to the signing so we can do with that documentary what we've been able to do with Seeds of Death against genetically modified organisms, by the way, which has gone viral, and millions of people around the world are now sharing that information. Also today from Lauren Stockman from EchoWatch.org, Oil Change International has published an article. I posted all these articles on my website, Why Canadian Tar Sands Are the Most Environmentally Destructive Project on Earth. Now, the president is about to sign, in the next week or two, the Keystone XL Tar Sands Pipeline Agreement. The arguments that he has stated and the State Department has agreed upon, their talking points are, it will give us tens of thousands of jobs, it's completely safe, and it will make us more efficient and more self-sufficient with energy. Those are all lies, as you will hear from these commentaries. Time permitting today, I will share what I thought was a really brilliant introspective analysis by Jimmy Carter, Losing My Religion for Equality, and theage.com from Australia. So I'll read what Jimmy Carter wrote about saying goodbye to his Southern Baptist friends. Why did it? Good for him. He did it for the right reasons. As you see, we have a packed show. I will not be taking calls today on our talkback segment that normally I would. Think of carrots. Most people are not aware that the lowly carrot is indeed the second most popular vegetable, after which the potato. And carrots are actually in the same family as parsnips, and fennel, caraway, and cumin, and dill. Now, as an organic certified farmer, I grow a lot of different carrots. I'm aware of at least 100 different varieties, but I'm sure that's in the United States, but I'm aware worldwide there are many others. They come in all different types of sizes. Some can grow 3 feet long, for example. Carrots have been around a long time. They started off as a wild root over 5,000 years ago in Afghanistan. And they were first cultivated prior to 900 AD. The original crops were purple or a slight purple yellowish. The purple carrots spread into the Mediterranean region, according to Marjorie King. And there, quote, from the 10th century and together with yellow variety later spread into Europe. Orange carrots, what we eat here in the United States today, are merely natural mutations of the yellow form, and they were developed in the Netherlands. The orange variety made its way to North America in the 17th century with the English settlers. For most people, the orange carrots are a very good source of beta carotene and the alpha carotene. Those will be converted into vitamin A in the body, which is good for us. They're loaded with phytochemicals, and it's good to eat them raw. They have a low glycemic index, but if you eat the carrot in the form of carrot juice, you're getting too much sugar. So I don't recommend carrot juice. I recommend steamed carrots, so you actually open up the oligocellulose, making the essential nutrients much more bioavailable. And its antioxidants are not reduced when you steam them. Or if you're going to juice them, blend the juice into a soup or make it into a puree or make it into a dip. For example, at my first restaurant, the Fertile Earth, which I know some of you ate at, it was up on 108th and Broadway. It was the first gourmet vegan restaurant in the United States. I had it for 7 years. It was a wonderful experience. There were only two entrees and two soups, two salads, two desserts per day. And people came in. It was like cafeteria style. You looked in, you saw what was there, and you ordered it. But it was the environment. The Berrigan brothers and all the leading artists and social activists would hang out there every night and talk about all the different things that were going on and what they were doing. It was a wonderful meeting place. And I made the first tofu dip, and I made it with tofu and tahini, adding some garlic and wee-free soy sauce and pepper and fresh basil. But then I started blending carrots. I'd make a carrot juice, and then I would blend the carrot juice with tofu in a blender and adding in cumin and cayenne and a little mustard seed, and that became a favorite topping. You could make it yourself and add any variable you want. Good over rice and beans, etc. Well, that's why the carrot is so important. But the purple carrot is richer than all the others in the anthocyanins. Antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanin, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S. Now, these are the very powerful antioxidants, and that's what gives you your red, blue, and purple colors of fruits and vegetables. And the anthocyanins also help reduce coronary heart disease, help maintain healthy eyes and vision, help protect against cancer, and help your brain. All that they do. So the anthocyanins are extremely important. In fact, there was a study at Harvard University that found that young and middle-aged women who ate higher levels of anthocyanins had 32% reduced risk of a heart attack compared to women eating less levels. And also, it's right up there with the benefits of eating blueberries, strawberries, eggplant, blackberries, and black currants. So just add purple carrots They're good for you. Now, another thing that's good for you that we don't really consume at all in the United States are the leaves of the carob tree. We've gotten so much emphasis on the health benefits of chocolate, we forget about carob. And for a long time, most of the chocolate in the United States contained lots of sugar and dairy. Well, for those who were on a dairy-free diet or a low-sugar diet, they went over to the carob powder, unsweetened carob powder, which gives you a chocolate-like quality, and then kind of went out of favor altogether. There's an interesting article in the American Chemical Society's Global Challenges and Chemistry Solutions podcast series that talks about the antibacterial extract from the leaves of the carob tree. And that could fight a lot of food poisoning and what is called listeriosis. So based upon a Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry report, they found that very powerful superbugs, the so-called antibiotic-resistant bacteria, could actually be killed by this extract. So my hope is that they'll start getting this carob leaf extract into stores and doctors' offices, because think of all the cases of listeria that can kill people. And what we know is carob is probably best known as a substitute for chocolate that does not contain caffeine or theobromine, which makes chocolate toxic to dogs. By the way, never give your dog or your bird chocolate. And what I found when I read the original scientific paper was that the carob leaves provide an effective way of inhibiting the growth of listeria bacteria growing in laboratory cultures. So good antibacterial effort there. I remember the first report showing that diet sodas that contain aspartame were dangerous. But then the whole aspartame and sugar industry put on a whole frontal assault and it kind of went away. But more people are drinking diet soda today than ever before. And aspartame, the artificial sweetener, is in there. That's when you see the zero calories. It's generally, but not always, aspartame. Now, new information, it's an 11-year study, according to Lisa Garber, by scientists at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where they found a strong positive correlation between degeneration of the kidney function and consumption of aspartame-containing diet soda. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal, Clinical Journal of American Society of Nephrology. They looked at 3,318 women for a number of years as they consumed diet soda containing artificial sweeteners like aspartame. They did blood work up and blood pressure and smoking habits and pre-existing conditions like heart disease and diabetes, and they went through all of these. They found that it was the aspartame. Now, a separate study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition showed that, contrary to safety claims by the manufacturers of aspartame, health-related concerns including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and leukemia are still there. And so, very concerned about this. Just a brief overview about the corruption with aspartame. A lot of people say, well, if it were bad, wouldn't it be banned? It would never have been allowed. But the reality is this is neither the first nor the last time that we will end up having something like an artificial sweetener that is bad and still gets out there, because the Food and Drug Administration quickly approved aspartame called NutraSweet. And in 1974, they allowed it in limited use in foods, but only after examining studies provided by GD Cereal Company. That's correct. The inventor of aspartame was the one who did the safety studies, not any independent outside group. It was only after the research psychiatrist concluded that aspartic acid, a key ingredient in aspartame, made holes in mice brains, that the FDA rounded up a task force to investigate Cereal's claims. The investigation unveiled a series of falsified claims and corrupted study results and information that simply wasn't there. Although the FDA moved for further investigation of Cyril by grand jury, U.S. Attorney Thomas Sullivan and Assistant U.S. Attorney William Conlon didn't lift a finger to help. And by the way, you guessed it, Conlon found a job at a law firm representing Cyril, the manufacturer of aspartame. And since then, the genetically modified creation aspartame has been implicated in a number of studies as causing tumors, seizures, brain holes, and reproductive problems. But the mainstream media won't report on any of it, and especially its aspartame cancer risk. Now, other artificial sweeteners like sucralose have been implicated in other health problems, like changing the gut flora environment to bad and preventing proper nutrient absorption. In fact, there was a Journal of Toxicology and Environmental Health that reported on this. So what do you do if you want a low-calorie sweetener? Stevia, S-T-E-V-I-A. Stevia is very good, and I would definitely suggest it. One last thing, effectively treating colorectal cancer with grape seed extract, even as the cancer gets more aggressive. Now, this is mainstream medicine. This I'm going to quote verbatim from Medical News Today. Quote, when the going gets tough, grape seed extract gets going. A University of Colorado Cancer Center study recently published in the Journal of Cancer Letters shows that the more advanced our colorectal cancer cells, the more the GSE inhibits, which is grape seed extract, their growth and survival. On the other end of the disease spectrum, grape seed extract leaves healthy cells alone entirely. Quote, we've known for quite a while that the bioactive compounds in grape seed extract selectively target many types of cancer cells. This study shows that many of the same mutations that allow colorectal cancer cells to metastasize and survive traditional therapies make them especially sensitive to treatment with grape seed extract. End quote. And that was from the lead investigator and the professor at the Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmacological Sciences. So that's good news. Now, back in a moment with our commentary. Please stay with us. These are some good ones.
Every star's a wishing star that shines for you. April love is all the seven wonders.
One little kiss. Well, this week I'll be sharing some musical selections from people who are baby boomers, music from the 50s and 60s. From Colin Todd Hunter, countercurrents.org, The Lies of Democracy and the Language of Deceit. In an increasingly media-driven age, language is everything and is often used by officialdom to tyrannize meaning. With the deaths of millions on its hands since 1945, the United States has become the world's number one terror state. By the 1980s, former CIA man John Stockwell had put the figure at 6 million. As a recent article has indicated, from mass bombing in Southeast Asia to employing death squads in South America, the U.S. military and the CIA have been directly and indirectly responsible for an updated figure of an estimated 10 million deaths. But it's not called mass murder these days. Ironically, the U.S. has hijacked the word terror to justify its brand of tyranny throughout a war on terror. You can also add to that 10 million countless others whose lives have been sacrificed on the altar of corporate profit, which did not rely upon the military to bomb people and countries into submission, but on certain policy. It's not browbeating, it's structural adjustment. As a result, hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers have taken their own lives over the past decade, and a large group has blamed the U.S. agriculture industry for manipulating global commodity prices, courtesy of policies enacted on its behalf by the U.S. government, or due to corporate monopoly, or frontier technology, or Terminator seeds that also landed farmers in debt, which was just too much for them to bear. The plight of Indian farmers is not unique. How many lives have been cut short across the world because of the inherent structural violence or silent killing of everyday, seemingly benign, functioning people working within predatory capitalism? The built-in inequalities of the system have effectively stolen years from people's lives, the health from their bodies, the livelihood from their hands, the water from their taps, and the food from their plates. From the UK to Africa, the subjugated classes, the now often discarded economic fodder, the cannon fodder during times of war, or the returning heroes to be thrown overboard by the system on coming home, the people who are to be manipulated and exploited at will via bogus notions of nationalism or the national interest, have had their lives cut short or stripped bare of opportunities due to the hardships imposed by the iron fist of capitalism. The appropriation of wealth through a system that funnels it from bottom to top via process of accumulation by disposition is celebrated as growth and prosperity and freedom of choice, despite evidence that from Greece to Spain, the reality from the majority has been increasing poverty, the stripping away of choice and misery. You wouldn't know much about this if you just used the mainstream media for information, though. Sure, you may have been told to tighten your belt because we are all in it together and must make some sacrifice in these difficult times. And as pirate bankers entrap us all, even further via their license to print and loan currencies to national governments, then also loan them the interest on it to spiral out of hand so it can never be repaid, they are able to line their pockets even further by buying up national assets on the cheap from the countries they bankrupted in the first place. It's not racketeering, they say, it's austerity. And now they're coming for your Social Security. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They get it always, sooner or later, because they own the place. So said George Carlin. And where is the mainstream media in all this? Where are those journalists who claim to be respectable in their rigid professionalism, their accountability, their objectivity? If you can call professionalism and accountability and objectivity being in the pocket of and not wishing to offend advertising interests and officialdom and lobbyists or corporate think tanks, then they are paragons of absolute virtue. Peddling their high-salaried lies, they have failed and continue to fail the public by shining their dim investigative light on parliamentary procedures, personalities, and rubber-stamping a policy in the inane machinations of party politics. They merely serve to maintain and perpetuate the status quo and keep the public in the dark as to the unaccountable self-serving power brokering and unity of interest that enable big oil and big banking and big farm and big agri and the rest of them to keep bleeding us dry. Looking back to the BBC's reporting of the NATO bombing of Libya provides quite revealing insight into the mainstream media. The coverage was disgracefully one-sided. Is the public to pay for public service broadcaster in order to be misled and for it to secure our compliance for illegal state corporate policies? There was little analysis of mission drift or of where the insurgents were getting their arms from, despite the UN-sanctioned arms embargo, much less of NATO's moral right to bomb a path into Tripoli. No talk there of what University of Johannesburg professor Chris Landsberg said was NATO's violation of international law, or of the 200 prominent African-American figures who accused Western nations of subverting international law. But that's how it works. That's why the state corporate fraudsters, murderers, and liars who wrap themselves in the language of freedom and democracy have been getting away with it for so long. Sadly, that's why they continue to do so. End quote. Now to something I think is important, and that is the environment. When we were in Washington, we helped support many people in this audience. Thousands came, and we thank you for coming to protest the the tar sands pipeline to protest genetic engineering and to try to get it labeled if we couldn't get it banned. But what you're up against as individuals and groups is you're up against a media that does not want to start off by looking for the truth and then see who is supporting the truth. Those of us, the Bill McKibbins and the others who have taken the time and energy to educate ourselves on something such as the tar sands? Or will they automatically start, as most media do, with the idea that it is only the official sources that represent the standard of truth? Everything else is a measure of deviation. So if you come at this looking with your homework at the truth, and if your truth is at variance with the official position of the White House, State Department, Pentagon, whatever it may be, you will never be given credibility. You will never be given top billing. You will not be given equal time and opportunity. You'll be the other. And that's why the White House can pass a law that ensures the pipeline gets through our continent and right out the back door so it can be sold overseas. However, today, according to Lauren Stockman, scientists and advocates speaking at the National Press Club in Washington unveiled new research showing that the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline would damage the climate much more than previously thought by dramatically expanding tar sands production, and because it will lead to increased combustion of a particularly dirty form of oil. Now, there's not one, but there's two reports that were presented. One was called Petroleum Coke, the coal hiding in the tar sands, that revealed that currently analysis of the impact of that tar sands fails to account for high carbon byproduct of the refining process that is a major source of climate change causing carbon emissions. It's called Petroleum Coke, known as Petcoke, P-E-T-C-O-K-E, Petcoke. And the other is the climate implications of the proposed Keystone oil sands pipeline from the Pembina Institute. That's a Canadian environmental think tank. And it talks about how the coal tar sands are increasing significantly greenhouse gas emissions. Now, it was Henry Waxman, who is the Energy and Commerce Committee ranking member, who made the following statement, quote, "The new report shows that TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline is the key that will unlock the tar sands. If the pipeline is approved, the world will face millions more tons of carbon pollution each year for decades to come. After Hurricane Sandy, devastating drought, unprecedented wildfires, and the warmest year on record, the United States, we know that climate change is happening now. We have to fight it now. And we must say no to this pollution pipeline now," end quote. The Canadian tar sands has been called the most environmentally destructive project on Earth, but for good reason. But what if we told you that a significant proportion of the climate impact from exploiting the tar sands had been overlooked? That's what we found in this story, in this latest report entitled Petroleum Coke, the coal hiding in the tar sands. It turns out that the analysis have been examining the liquid fuels derived from the tar sands bitumen and calculating the emissions associated with producing those light liquid fuels, like gasoline and diesel, and adding the emissions from burning those liquid fuels to derive a, what is called a well-to-the-wheels analysis of emissions. On this basis alone, the European Commission has determined that the emissions from the tar sands fuel are 23% greater than fuel from conventional crude used in Europe. But tar sands bitumen is a semi-solid hydrocarbon. In fact, a barrel of bitumen contains 24% more carbon than a barrel of conventional light oil. This additional carbon does not make its way through to the gasoline and diesel manufacturing from tar sands bitumen. It is removed, and this removed carbon doesn't disappear. It doesn't go away. Far from it. In fact, 15 to 30% of a barrel, that's a lot, of tar sands bitumen is converted during the refining process into a coal-like solid fuel called petroleum coke, or pet coke. And this is considered a byproduct of tar sands refining. And most analysis assessing the climate impact of the tar sands have to date dismissed the emissions from burning this pet coke. They have done this partly because they have not developed a methodology to include pet coke emissions in their calculations of the emissions from the liquid fuels. So, you have two new studies, and they both show how bad it is. But let me just give you an overview now. Here is the truth of it. Pet coke is like coal, but in fact, it's dirtier. Pet coke has even higher carbon emissions than already carbon-intensive coal, emitting between 5 to 10% more CO2 than coal unit of energy produced. A ton of pet coke yields on average 53.6% more CO2 than a ton of coal. So even if pet coke did simply replace coke or coal, which is not the case, the net emissions from whichever activity the pet coke is fueling, power generations, are higher. But because pet coke is a byproduct, refineries price it to move, meaning it is selling into the market at around 25% discount to coal. Now we all know the basic law of economics. More supply equal lower prices equals more demand. But growing supplies of pet coke are not only adding to the global supply of fuel for coal-fired power generators, they are undercutting coal on price. Indeed, industry analysts have shown that a typical 1-gigawatt coal plant can save around $120 million per year in fuel costs by blending pet coke with coal in their boilers. That sounds to us like a boom for coal-fired generators and a bad deal for cleaner fuels competing with coal in a tight market. Pet coke is the tar sands, in the tar sands, is turning American refineries into coal factories. Remember, there's 24% more CO2 embedded in a barrel of tar sand bitumen than in a barrel of light oil. And 15 to 30% of a barrel of tar sand bitumen can end up as pet coke, depending upon the upgrading and refining process. And of 134 operating U.S. refineries, as of right now, 59 are equipped to produce pet coke. And U.S. refineries produced more than 61.5 million tons of pet coke last year. And 60% of U.S. pet coke production was exported. And Keystone Pipeline will fuel 5 coal plants and thus emit 13% more CO2 than the U.S. State Department has previously considered. So you just have to understand this. 9 of the refineries close to the southern terminus of Keystone have nearly 30% of the U.S. pet coke production capacity. That's 50,000 tons a day. And the pet coke produced by the Keystone XL pipeline would fuel 5 coal plants and produce 16.6 million metric tons of CO2 each year. And these pet coke emissions have been excluded from the State Department emissions estimates for the Keystone pipeline. Including these emissions raises the total amount of what will be in the air by 13%. And it's cheap. Remember, pet coke is cheap to the coal industry. So that's the fact of it. And yet you have Oxbow Carbon donated $4 million to the GOP super PACs, making it one of the largest corporate donors for super PACs to make sure that their pipeline got done. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For those who do not believe that conspiracies exist and therefore deny that organizations, individuals get together for the intent an exclusive purpose of defrauding people for their gain and someone else's loss. Here's something that John F. Kennedy had to say about hidden conspirators.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program. For from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence. And the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news. For it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
So we must ask ourselves at this time, how many people within the media are honoring the transparency, the openness, the willingness to look for the truth within a story, within an official statement, within a declaration? How many then supported the truth when it was said we had weapons of mass destruction? They all lined up. How many looked for the truth in the National Defense Authorization Act, or looked for the truth when there were people saying the bankers are behind much of our problems? And people said, nonsense. That's just rants from lunatics, fringe elements. But they were right. You do not have to be articulate to be correct on an issue. You can be angry. But should we fear people who have truth, not 100%, but at some measurable percent more than what they do not have? But their anger frequently distracts from that truth. This is just but one example.
I'm the one that's turning the ship around. I'm the one that's got all the conservative hosts aping my information and my talking points because I'm original and I've done the real research. Okay? I'm leading the pack, and all these fake jackass conservatives know it. They know it and they can't stand it.
And there could be another perspective as well to Alex Jones, that yes, there are conspiracies, and yes, people in powerful positions within the banking community, within the confines of a narrow group of individuals, the elitist at the business roundtable, those who advise Alec from the Council on Foreign Relations, those who look at the larger world community and see how their personal fortunes or those of the corporations they control could be influenced in a positive way. It's not about running the world. It's not about having a one-world government. It is about megalomania and greed, something far more basic. And yet, where Alex Jones serves a definite need for the group of individuals who want to hear his message, it is important also to temper the I with realizing that it has always been the we. Because before there was Alec Jones, who's only been around the last dozen or so years, there were early people who did not have all the resources but had the will, the intellect, and the passion for discovering the truth. Helen Hunt Jackson, a woman, one of the first real muckrakers, who did a long expose entitled The Century of Dishonor. In 1881, what did she do? She was the first person to show in its completeness the U.S. government's mistreatment, abuse, and genocide against Native Americans. Ida Minerva Tarbell was an American teacher. She was a journalist. And she was one of the leading, what we called then the muckrakers, of the progressive era. She wrote a book in 1904 entitled The History of the Standard Oil Company, which was listed number 5 in a 1999 list of the New York University's top 100 works of the 20th century in American journalism. So before there was Alec Jones, there was Ida. And before there was the Trilateral Commission, there was the History of the Standard Oil and the Rockefellers. There was Samuel Hopkins Adams, who in 1905 told us all about the great American fraud. In it, he exposed the dangers of the medicines and the false claims of patent medicine at the time. By the way, at that time, many of the medicines contained high net levels of narcotics like cocaine and opium and alcohol. Then you had Julius Chambers, who was an American author and journalist and an activist against psychiatric abuse. In 1872, he was committed to Bloomingdale Asylum to obtain information about alleged abuse of inmates. After 10 days, his collaborators on the project had him released. And then he wrote a series of articles that were published in the Tribune that led to the release of 12 patients who were not mentally ill, and reorganization of the staff administration of the Institute, and eventually to change the lunacy laws in the United States. This later led to the publication of the book, The Mad World and Its People, in 1876. How much power did he have? The power of the pen. And he was speaking on behalf of mental issues clear back then, and the abhorrent conditions that people were having to live through. And then you had Nellie Bly. She went by the name, pen name, of Elizabeth Jane Cochran. And she remains notable for two feats, a record-breaking trip around the world in emulation of Jules Verne's character of Fog, and an expose in which she faked insanity to study mental institutions from within. She was also an industrialist and charity worker. And she wrote the book 10 Days in a Madhouse. It caused a major sensation. It embarrassed the physicians. A grand jury launched its own investigation into the conditions. Ida Well, an African-American writer whose ultimate goal was to fight for her race and expose the events of lynching. When 3 of her friends were lynched because a group of white men wanted to extinguish their competition in the grocery store business, she exposed their horrific acts. She wrote about the motives of the white mob and advice on how her race would protect themselves. Her newspaper, Free Speech and Headlight, was eventually shut down because of the investigative journalism that she was involved in. She was able to continue her work in representing people who had been lynched. She eventually joined the NAACP and became a leader among her race. She is one of the first black women to run for office in America. And David Graham Phillips is known for producing one of the most important investigative details ever, exposing big business and its relationship to the Senate, and particularly Standard Oil Company. He was among a few writers at the time promoting investigations of muckrakers, or by muckrakers. He actually coined the term. And Edward Murrow, remember him? Edward R. Murrow rose to the international fame during the Second World War as the London correspondent for CBS Radio. And he saw the encroachment of civil rights by the actions of Joe McCarthy in his campaign to root out communist infiltration of American society, and he decided to get to the truth. He used McCarthy's own speeches against him. He was a brave man. Charles Edward Russell was an American journalist, crusaded for social change, and founded the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He's also often called the Prince of Muckrakers. He reported on the corrupt practices and inhumane conditions at Chicago stockyards, where inspection was completely wrong. And that led to Upton Sinclair's powerful novel, The Jungle, which caused a national uproar that led to inspection reforms. How important is that? Just imagine what you would eat today if that didn't happen. And Lincoln Steffens, writing for the New York Evening Post and McClure's on important issues, including the corruption known to man, everything, municipal governments. He wrote a book called The Shame of Cities, where he outlined the cruel inequality machinery that operated in all areas of municipal life. And Upton Sinclair, of course, he was specific on labor abuses. He went undercover for 7 weeks gathering data on the horrific practice of the Chicago meat industry, and it caused major sensation and change because of it. Andrew Russell Drew Pearson was one of the best-known American columnists of his day, noted for his syndicated column, The Washington Merry-Go-Round, in which he was not afraid to attack anything, including Joseph McCarthy. And then there's Isidore Feinstein Stone, better known as I.F. Stone. What a great journalist and muckraker he was. In fact, he was ranked 16th in the poll of his fellow journalists, the top 100 works of journalism in the United States in the 20th century. He exposed the FBI for the nation during the war, caused a sensation, deeply embarrassed J. Edgar Hoover. Stone was the only American journalist to challenge President Lyndon B. Johnson's account of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And Rachel Carson, my goodness, never, ever should someone put their own ego ahead of the reality of what history has shown us. We wouldn't have an environmental movement today if it weren't for her and her Silent Spring in 1962 and how pesticides were harming the environment. And Jessica Lucy Friedman Mitford was an English author and journalist turned muckraker. And in May of 1961, she traveled to Montgomery, Alabama to meet the arrival of the Freedom Riders and became caught up in a riot when a mob led by the Ku Klux Klan attacked the civil rights activists. And after the riot, she proceeded to rally led by Martin Luther King Jr. And the church at which this was held was also attacked by the Klan. And Mitford and the group spent the night barricaded inside until the violence was ended. She wrote The American Way of Death, which criticized the funeral industry. And John Howard Griffin was an American journalist, best known for darkening his skin and journeying through Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, and Georgia to experience segregation in the Deep South in 1959. And today you have Ralph Nader, Seymour Hersh, Gary Webb, Greg Palast, John Richard Pilger, Barbara Ehrenreich, Mark Crispin Miller, Julian Assange. So just remember that there are many people, hundreds, thousands, who dared risk everything in order for us to have a form at all. And finally, the planet we have assaulted will convulse with fury. The senseless greed of limitless capitalist expansion will implode the global economy. The decimation of civil liberties carried out in the name of fighting terror will shackle us to an interconnected security and surveillance state that stretches from Moscow to Istanbul to New York. To endure what lies ahead, we will have to harness the human imagination. It was the human imagination that permitted African Americans during slavery and the Jim Crow era to transcend their physical condition. It was the human imagination that sustained Sitting Bull and Black Elk as their land was seized and their cultures were broken. It was the human imagination that allowed survivors in the Nazi death camps to retain the power of the sacred. It is the imagination that makes possible transcendence. Chants, work songs, spirituals, the blues, poetry, dance, and art converged under slavery to nourish and sustain this imagination. These were the forces that, as Ralph Ellison wrote, we had in place of freedom. The oppressed would be the first, for they know their fate. To admit that on a rational level such as a notion is absurd, but they also know that it is only through the imagination that they survived. Jewish inmates in Auschwitz reportedly put God on trial in the Holocaust and then condemned God to death. A rabbi stood after the verdict to lead the evening prayers. African Americans, Native Americans for centuries had little control over their destinies. Forces of bigotry and violence kept them subjugated by whites. Suffering for the oppressed was tangible. Death was a constant companion, and it was only their imagination, as William Faulkner noted at the end of The Sound and the Fury, that permitted them, unlike the novel's white comps and family, to endure. The theologian James Cone captures this in his masterpiece, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Cone says that for oppressed blacks, the cross was a paradoxical religious symbol because it inverts the world's value system with the news that hope comes by way of defeat, that suffering and death do not have the last word, and that the last shall be first and the first last. Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. It reminds me of when I hear the rants, to understand that maybe we need more rants. As an aside, when Alex Jones screams, separate out his passion and separate out the excess of his hyperbole with the nugget of truth that remains, was it not Reinhold Niebuhr who stated that in order for us to challenge all forces of repression, we need a sublime madness in the soul? Did he not say, nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places? He knew that sublime madness is dangerous, but he also knew that it was essential. As Chris Hedges said, it is vital. Without it, he said, truth is obscured. And what do we have to say, and what did he believe about the traditional liberalism? He said it was a useless force in moments of extremity. liberalism, he said, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is too intellectual and too little emotional to be an efficient force in history. So, as Chris Hedges would lead us to understand, sublime madness permits the rest of us to view the possibilities of a world otherwise seen only by the visionary, the artist, the madman. And it permits us to fight for these possibilities. Was it not the prophets in the Hebrew Bible who had this sublime madness? The words of the Hebrew prophets, as Abraham Heschel wrote, were a scream in the night while the world is at ease and asleep. The prophets feel the blast from heaven. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for listening.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day.
We will take a few minutes now for you to have an opportunity for TalkBack. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we have first up, Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, you basically addressed a little bit of my first email. I've got something here from Myron, and he says, for almost 20 years, he's been a staunch Democrat. You know, reads Mother Jones, The Nation, listens to BAI, NPR. And then he began to realize that after the last two elections and seeing what Obama has done, that he couldn't be a good Democrat any longer because his people are not willing to hold Obama accountable. All of his corporate backings, especially those involving our country, bailing out two big corporations and doing nothing for the poor and the working class. Now I only listen to PRN where there's real progressive information. I realize that my values are more in line with traditional liberal conservatives than with anything within the Democratic Party. He says, over the last 20 years, if anyone tried to argue a point with me, I would essentially close down, get defensive, not listen. And recently, he said, I watched Alex Jones. And he says that he has a hard time understanding Jones, especially after he went ballistic on Piers Morgan and subsequent interviews. And his question is, why do people find him of interest?
George Bernard Shaw said, the worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. That's the essence of inhumanity. When you look at the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans from Clinton and Obama, perfect, absolutely perfection in corporate democracy, support the neo-colonial agenda, support war, support the military-industrial complex, support corporate welfare, and deny the virtue of human welfare. Deny that 70% of the American population even exists except when you want their vote, and stay aligned with those that pay the bills now and in the future. Stay close to the power base, and people are not considered a power base. Look at Rush Limbaugh. Bombastic, anti-intellectual, anti-spiritual, anti-humanistic, anti-progressive, anti-environmental, anti-creative. So why would he have such a large audience? Relatively simple. For those people who want very clear black and white issues to align with. He represents their voice. Bill O'Reilly's the same. Bill's looking out for you, doesn't he say? And in his own inimitable, sometimes chirpish, sometimes strident, sometimes angry, sometimes humorous way, he evokes the kind of everyday person that becomes successful and has that unique inside look. And so people like him as well. As they do with Sean Hannity, highly militaristic, highly radically nationalistic, who never sees the negative side of exceptionalism, manifest destiny, and the genocide of the American Indians or African Americans. Oh, that's in the past. Wash it away. Learn no lesson. It's not here today. And so, and you have the same on the left. The ideologues on the left, who I will not mention, who will never question anything of a corporate nature if they are aligned with it. Vaccinations, the AIDS dynamic, mental health screening. They wouldn't oppose that. They would support it. And yet will not challenge those in power if they are the same party, irrespective of their indiscriminate nature. So what Alex Jones does, and he does it very well, is he is the voice for those who are most marginalized, the poor working class, those who've been completely excluded from any dialogue and any authentic representation. So he then finds the enemies, and the enemies are the New World Order, and the enemies are the Bilderbergs, and the enemies are the bankers. Now, there are grains of truth in all that. And in some areas, he is more in alignment with the facts than in others. But there's an enormous amount of supposition. But to those people who want, who are the enemies, then he, the internment camps, and taking something that has 30% truth and provability, and adding in a healthy amount of his own subjective analysis, he has 100% conviction of the people who are not going to look critically and carefully at the issues. But he is also more right than wrong on those issues. And that's the puzzlement. We're used to saying someone's either right or wrong on an issue. What if they're partially right? What if they're right in substance? Is it not the bankers who have inordinate control? Aren't they the ones who are bailed out to $20 trillion totally now? Don't they control our virtual currency and the value of our currency and world trade? They do. Can't they get unlimited amounts of money at zero interest? They can. But that doesn't mean that they're heading towards a world government. That doesn't mean that all the internment camps are meant for dissenters to be in prison. That doesn't mean that all those coffins are to bury the dissenters. So how you take something and you extrapolate it out of context is extremely relevant. And then the dynamic energy of your presentation. I have no problem with people who want to sing their message or scream their message, because I'm really listening to the message. And I'm looking for the truth in the message, not their presentations. Each and every one of us has our own idiosyncratic way of delivering our message. So he has a very large following, because there are a very large number of people that are not your corporate Democrats or corporate Republicans. And he's tapped into that. So remember, I once said, the group that will stand up and protest, the group that will ultimately defend America, will not be the intellects. They wouldn't defend anything except intellectually. It will not be your professional class, the doctors, lawyers, engineers, the accountants, the professors. Intellectually, they can be sympathetic, but you'd rarely see them in the marches. Of all the marches and demonstrations, 15 last year alone, how many of these, the professional class did you see there? Not even 1%. It will not be the older senior citizens. They're not protesting anything, with a rare individual exception. They're gone. It's not going to be the youth. They're not protesting, except unless they're in a small occupied movement, and that's under 0.1% of the 80 million under 18. It's not going to be the working class. They're focused upon accepting their truth by how they've aligned themselves, and all they want in return is some security and diversion. And that's what the entertainment industry does. And what that leaves then, it leaves the poor working class, which is about 100 million people. And they're the ones who have to work two jobs. They're the ones who have maybe a whole family living at home with them beyond their immediate family. They're the ones who look at this and say, why is it that all these other people are being helped and we're not? They're the ones who are looking through the eyes and listening through the words of Alex Jones at how he interprets the finality of all social issues and political drama. And that's the tinderbox. That is the one most volatile. And so his emotional volatility, he's extremely forceful, and he has a large group of people behind him. Rush Limbaugh would be lucky to get, 2,000-3,000 people out. This guy could get a million people going. So I've told you all along, if there's ever going to be any real fire back in the United States as far as the intemperance of a whole group, it'll come only when extreme austerity and an economic downturn occur in the United States, which will probably be in the next 24 months. And then you'll see that whole group, no other group, that group will go in your face. They will develop a support system similar to Alex's temperament. And you do so at your own mistake to simply say, this is a ranting lunatic, write him off, he has no basis in truth. He has a lot of basis in truth, but he also has his own unique and extreme way of presenting it. Does that answer your question?
It sure does. Gives us way more insight than we ever imagined.
Thanks a lot. I'm Gary Noll. Utrece Leeds up now. Hi, Utrece.
Hi, Gary. Today being the fortuitous meeting of an inauguration and the celebration of Dr. King's Day, I thought it appropriate that we feature messages from King to Obama.
Good. I'm waiting to hear what these messages are.
Yeah.
Utrece Leeds, right now on Progressive Radio Network. Please stay with us.
April love is for the very young. Every star's a wishing star that shines for you.